We did, but that's what I thought.
Next semester, next year, I'm hoping to get into judicial counsel. I want to be a JC member more than sitting on the
panels. I wasn't involved in SGA, but everybody was.
There's none right now.
Well, that's excellent.
Like, we're killing it.
That's great.
All right. We are in, what class is this? Number 8 on Modern Challenges. And we are going to do one class on, well, let me put this up. So we've already talked about all of these subjective needs that we have and how God has better answers for these things than any other worldview. And so now we're shifting from the subjective evidences for Christianity, and now we're moving to the objective answer. What did I just say? Subjective evidences? Now we're moving to the objective evidences. Here. Give me this.
Thank you. The extras right here.
When I say subjective, I mean like when you look within yourself, subjectively speaking, God's got the best answers for what we need. Now we're looking at objective arguments. Jim, there's a copy right there.
Okay.
For tonight. And so by objective, I mean more like, here's like logical arguments that are kind of like outside of you that you present to people to show like, this is why it's reasonable to believe in God and Christianity. And as I was looking at my old notes from the first and second time I ever did these classes with atheists. And a lot of the times we stopped after these subjective needs, and then we'd start studying the Bible. But there's some of the times where we would get into these objective things as well. And we've got to spend two classes on the questions about the existence of God because of all the things that I want to try to cover. So this week and next week, we'll talk about questions on the existence of God. We might have to split the questions about the Bible into two classes. Jesus, we should probably be able to do in one class because some of this cascades into Jesus, and there will be certain things that we don't need to repeat in that. But we'll talk about whether or not Christianity stole from pagan religions. Have you guys ever heard people say that Christianity just like borrowed and copied from other religions, and it's like a mishmash of other things? So we'll talk about that in that class. And then next quarter, I'm teaching Sunday mornings, and we're going to do Song of Solomon, but we're going to include a lot of like the cultural, like transgenderism and all that sort of thing into those classes. So that's when we'll do that. Reminders of what we're doing, hoping to show that Christianity makes better sense of the world. And when we say world, we mean like within you it makes better sense that it would be true. But now we're moving to the objective things, that when we start looking at the world itself, that it makes better sense to go with the Christian worldview rather than any other. So we're hoping to do all these other things. Causes of skepticism. What are some of the causes of it, as we've talked about?
Desire to sin.
Yep.
Had religious experience.
Yep. One more.
Emotional.
All of these are emotional barriers.
Cultural.
Yeah, so you got the cultural background beliefs, but all of these, one of the big points we've been making from all of this, like Madison said, is that these are like all emotional reasons. So the skeptic that we encounter today, they might have all of these objective sounding arguments against Christianity, but a lot of them are really emotion driven. So what we're dealing with tonight, I've titled the class Faith Assumptions in Doubt. You guys all know what I mean by that? When people have doubts about like the existence of God, and they've got their arguments on, well, God couldn't exist because of this argument. What I want to do tonight in this class is help us think about how to doubt the doubts that people have. So like somebody might say, well, I don't believe in God because, and one of the things we're going to talk about is the problem of evil as an example. And they'll say, well, the problem of evil is such a rock solid reason why there couldn't be a God. And what I want us to do is kind of unmask, well, there's assumptions it requires faith to believe that that's a problem, to not believe in God. Does that make sense? So when people think that they've got a rock solid reason to not believe in God or Christianity, their worldview or their propositions that they're putting forth require some kind of faith of its own as well. This is the controlling question for this whole class. And Nick, there's some material there. Somebody can hand it to you.
There's the material, yeah, whatever.
Okay, so here's the basic thing that we're doing in this class. When we hear somebody have, like, doubts on the existence of God for our class today, we have to ask this, the question, what assumption is behind this doubt that they're bringing up? So what I want to do in the class is we're going to bring up four of maybe the more popular arguments in our society today as to why people don't believe in God. And then I want us to think together, well, what are the faith assumptions that are built up behind the doubt? And if you're not getting it so far, we'll kind of, as we start to work through this, I think we'll see it. So here's the first argument. The first reason why a lot of people don't believe in God is the problem of evil and suffering. Now, can anybody explain what this so-called problem is? Yeah, Matt?
This is the idea that if God is all-powerful and all... Or he can't be all-powerful and all-good because there's evil in the world. And so he... Like, if he's all-good...
Why does he allow the evil inside?
Why does he allow evil? If he's all-powerful, that means he can't stop evil.
And David Hume was one of the first people to really make this as an argument, and he said this, I don't know what year he wrote this, but he said, the he in this quote is referring to God, is he willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent, or he doesn't have power. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent, or not loving. Is he both able and willing? Whence then is evil? So, have you guys heard people say this? Like, why would a loving God allow evil and suffering? So David Hume is one of the first people to really start making this as an argument. Now, before we get into the faith assumptions you have in order to believe that, I will point out that you don't read this kind of argument against the existence of God until David Hume. So before the Enlightenment, this was not an argument people used to disbelieve in God. Anybody know why?
Well, I can give an I can give a possibility.
Sure, let's hear it.
I think around this time, I could be wrong, but I think around this time, wasn't the whole world, but Christianity had technically made it to the New World and had probably been spread to the point where it was the dominant religion, and therefore then, you know, what's next to be questioned, so to speak.
Sure, and when you couple that with the Enlightenment.
Well, but also you look at a lot of the more older religions, and it's easy to kind of put critique on them because of the flaws of the deities in those.
Exactly, yeah.
But now that all these old religions have kind of disappeared or become not as pronounced, all of a sudden now you have Christianity as the new big religion, and technically Islam was having some similarities to Christianity,
right,
in terms of monotheism. So now, where do you turn to with the skepticism, basically?
Yeah, good. McCordon and Matt?
Is it possible that it's because a growing understanding of evil in the world, understanding of...
Yeah, maybe especially like when like some of the wars that have happened and all these things, it's like, well, it's becoming more and more apparent. And then you couple that again with the Enlightenment, where people are thinking in enlightened kind of ways or something like that. Matt?
I have a question. Where is David Hume from?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I should know that. Can you look up on your phone?
Yeah. Because that would... I mean, the time period in which he lived... is just briefly before a lot of revolutionary acts across the world.
I want to say he was French, but I might be wrong.
Then that makes a lot of sense.
Can you look it up, though? Just fact check me on that.
And the reason is, I'm saying this, because there's a greater class disparity growing between the upper echelon of society and the lower class. And so there's a lot more poverty and suffering happening more than ever.
And so this would be a reaction to what?
That's... That would be my guess.
But. Scottish Enlightenment philosopher.
Scottish, okay, all right. So one thing also is that in before the Enlightenment taught, they didn't have like an Enlightenment book, but what the Enlightenment movement taught people to think is that human rationality can answer all problems. And if we cannot answer a problem, then that means that that thing is not really a problem. We'll just get rid of it. and the problem is that people believe in this thing, so if we get rid of this idea of God, then this problem just goes away, because human rationality can't explain why a good and loving God would allow the evil and suffering. So, before the Enlightenment, people trusted that if there is a God big enough to make the world, he would also, might have things that he doesn't reveal to us that don't always make sense to us. That was the more prevailing thought before the Enlightenment. But we live in an Enlightenment society where this is a powerful argument. Do you guys think that this argument has some persuasion to it? Is there some persuasive nature to this argument? Because, the Bible teaches that God is love, but then you, take a history class and see what happened in World War II, or you think about some really poor country where people are being mistreated by their folks. That is a troubling question. Why would a loving God allow all of the wickedness that we see in the world? But what we have to ask is, what faith assumptions are behind this doubt? What do you guys think?
That evil comes from God.
What was that?
That evil comes from God.
Yeah, that was. So they would say that God is allowing it. Oh. So if they're going to be charitable, they might not say that he caused it. But some of them would say that. Because if he's allowing it, he still kind of has to have some kind of responsibility for even allowing it to begin with. But in that case, then the response would be, you're assuming that God is the one that originated it when the Bible says that he did not. It was humans that did that. So yeah. What other faith assumptions are behind this?
I mean, I think you assume that your consciousness and God's consciousness are of the same genre.
Yes.
The concept that our timelines are even similar.
Right, that almost
that existence is the existence.
Right.
And that there isn't anything outside of it.
Right, as if we should have the same level of understanding as him. C. Stephen Evans, he doesn't believe this, but he was giving a caricature of what people believe that think that this kind of thing is a powerful argument. He says, if God had a good reason for allowing evil, I would know what that reason is. So sometimes a Christian might respond by saying, well, maybe God does have a good reason for allowing evil and suffering, but you don't know what that answer is. And the Enlightenment thinker would say, well, we should know. Well, if God is big enough to make the world, wouldn't he also have the right to withhold information from you that maybe if he was to reveal it right now, it wouldn't even make sense to you anyways? So the faith assumption is that there would not be a good reason for a loving God to allow the evil and suffering. Could there be a good reason for God to allow the evil and suffering?
Does he allow us to have free will?
Yeah, he allows it. So free will, that would be a good thing for that. Yeah, McCord?
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of something else. I was going to add on with assuming that evil comes from evil, with the kids, the kids are dying,
mm-hmm.
other worlds or other countries, that they're going to hell. The assumption is that they're going to hell and that God isn't going to save them.
Right, your worldview is also saying that if people are dying and stuff like that, that's it. Okay, well, if you're going to criticize the Christian worldview, do it from within the Christian worldview. Our worldview says that there's an eternity and this life is not all there is. So don't just take the death side of it and neglect what the rest of the Christian worldview says. That's a common thing that I brought up to the skeptics when I studied with them, is that if you're going to critique the Christian worldview, do it from within the Christian worldview. Otherwise, it's not a proper critique. But you can start to see already that when we start to discuss the objective reasons for the faith, these things become more potentially divisive than the subjective things that cause you to look inside. And so the faith assumption is that God, a loving God, could never have a good reason for allowing evil and suffering. And I think he could have a good reason that maybe we don't know, and we can even understand some of the things with free will. But in our country, does the government allow people to drive cars? How many people die in car accidents every year? Why does the government allow evil and suffering? So, could there be some good benefit to allowing certain kinds of risks? So we can reason from those kinds of things, but you're assuming that those things couldn't be the case with God. Here's another thing to say about this. C.S. Lewis said, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how I got this idea of just... But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument was against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. We would know what the reason is. Oh, sorry, that's two quotes kind of got pushed together here, at least on my thing. Yeah, that's not supposed to be there at the very end. Anyways, okay, what's C.S. Lewis saying here? Yeah, Matt?
How do we define just and unjust?
Yeah.
That's his whole, he's like, I'm comparing the universe and saying it's unjust, but compared to what? Is it to my, like, he goes on, is it my personal idea? Well, my personal idea doesn't define just versus unjust.
Right.
So basically the argument is, how can we call something unjust when we don't know?
When your worldview doesn't even give you a definition of justice. So you're by faith, you have this idea of justice and what's right and wrong, but your worldview doesn't even give that to you. Go back to some of the previous conversations we had on morality.
I think having a good understanding of the Book of Job would help in regards to this argument, because that is an example of evil and suffering happening.
That God allowed for a greater purpose to prove something to Satan and the demons and all that sort of thing. So yeah, good. Do you guys see the nature of this argument? Whenever somebody has a doubt, you try to have to ask what assumptions are they making in their doubts. That's the first example. There's always a lot more to say about this topic. But another thing that we could say is that God is doing something about the evil and suffering in the world. Jesus is the king. There's going to be the resurrection. All of that sort of thing. So there is a future where God will actually deal with it. If you don't have God and you don't believe in God, there is ultimately no answer to the evil and suffering. Whether you're a Christian or not, evil and suffering is a reality. Which worldview equips you to handle the reality of evil and suffering? Does atheism? I heard a story one time about there was a debate between somebody who believed in Christianity and somebody who was an atheist. And the atheist asked the Christian guy, he's like, all right, if there is a six-year-old dying in a hospital bed from cancer, what does the Christian say about that? And the Christian's response was, what does the atheist say? Like, we can at least say that there's an afterlife and that we've got a way to describe why there's evil and suffering in the world through the free will of people and what Satan did and all these things. We've got a story that answers these things. But in atheism, you don't have that. So that's the first one. Any other comments or questions on the problem of evil and suffering? Yeah.
I think it's also a sense of entitlement. Because especially when Stephen Evans says, I would know what that reason is.
Right.
That's just an entitlement of, I need to know that, and not putting your faith below, in somebody else and below somebody else is puffing yourself up more and not humbling.
Which is, this is the Enlightenment era that we ought to know.
Yeah.
And if we don't know, then it's stupid. You know, man, I don't know if they talk that way.
And what I find really interesting is, like, we're approaching this from also, like, an atheistic point of view. This also is very applicable to other world religions. I'm doing a study right now in one of my classes on Buddhism and Hinduism. And Buddhism works to answer the question of, if there's suffering, how do you end that suffering? And, of course, the whole thing is, like, reincarnation and whatever. So it's like, you die, you're reincarnated, you suffer again. How do you stop that? This directly answers that, no, I mean, it's not reincarnation, but there is an end to suffering through God.
Right.
And so this isn't just, like, a problem with atheism that you can address, but also with those around the world who believe in different religions. So.
Right. Yeah. Good. All right. And I hope we have time to get to the 1 Kings passage, because we're going to come back to some of that in a way. So the next one is the problem of one right religion. Catherine Osmond has helped us a lot. She was the atheist that wrote Grace Without God. Here's another quote from her. As knowledge and awareness of other cultures and beliefs spread, it becomes increasingly difficult to see your own way as the only right one. Religions have always evolved, and those that haven't have withered and died. Of course, some evolved more successfully than others. So what she's saying here is another way of saying that it's hard to believe that there's one right way, and Christians who say there is one right religion and everybody else is wrong, It's people like you that say things like this that make me think God is just a joke anyway. So this is, have you guys heard people say this kind of thing before? How could there be one right way and one right religion? So here's the question. What faith assumptions are behind this?
That they're right.
That they're right. Isn't this another way, isn't this quote her own religious view that she thinks is right? So she's making the same mistake she's accusing other people of. Yeah.
Okay, I always talk about this, like when we're talking about absolute truth, if you say there is no absolute truth, then you're saying like something that you believe is absolutely true. So,
right. So the best response to that, so say there's no absolute truth.
There's no absolute truth.
Is that true? That's the way you answer that one. Not with the head thing, though. yeah, good. So you see the same mistake here. If you say, you know, all religions kind of have some truth in it and there can't be one right way, I am teaching a right way that would supersede these other ways. So here's some quotes on this. So Timothy Keller says, ironically, the insistence that doctrines do not matter is really a doctrine itself. It holds a specific view of God, which is touted as superior and more enlightened than the beliefs of most major religions. So the proponents of this view do not do the very thing that they forbid in others, which is what we just talked about. Another thing that Timothy Keller said about this. How could you possibly know that no religion can see the whole truth unless you yourself have the superior comprehensive knowledge of spiritual reality you just claimed that none of the religions have? So that's a good, concise way of saying that sort of thing. By the way, I think any group of people they're going to be narrow-minded. Have we talked about this before? So, like, let's say that I want to join PETA, like the people that protect animals, but I only eat meat all the time. Will they accept me? No. Well, that's narrow-minded of them, isn't it? What was that? Yeah, if they don't, they can smell the steak on me. They would want to. Any group that's going to have any degree of unity only has that unity because of shared beliefs. So if I want to be called this political party or that political party, but I hold the opposing views, but I still want to be accepted by them, I'm not going to be accepted by them. So for Christianity to say, well, this is the one true religion, this is the path to God, any counter to that by nature will be narrow-minded. Does that make sense? Like everybody in a sense is narrow-minded in that way because they have a worldview that they think is right and ergo the other ones are wrong. Now, so if everybody's narrow-minded, the question then becomes, which worldview allows me to hold my narrow-mindedness with love and compassion and being able to still listen to other people? Well, that's Christianity, so we went on that one too. Okay, so any comments or questions on this problem?
Wouldn't their opposition to that be, well, you're being narrow-minded because you say there's only one? Like, they might not be pressing to say, like, you're wrong, but they're like, they might be saying you're wrong for saying everyone else is wrong. Does that make sense?
Right, and you could say, well, you're being wrong by giving like credence to your worldview that says that mine is wrong.
Right, yeah.
So you're being just as narrow-minded as I am. So like when people say Christians are narrow-minded, well, so are you. We're all narrow-minded. And there's not necessarily something bad about that. Like we should be able to dialogue and hear different views with love and compassion, but everybody, in a sense, has got a narrow viewpoint on things. Yeah, Jim?
But narrow-mindedness comes from self-will and being self-centered. And some of the things that we've talked about, but, you know, that can be true however you believe.
Right. Yeah, so, like, it's not like this is some, even Christians that are, like, in an ungodly way, narrow-mindedly dogmatic and whatever, are you going to find the same thing with atheists? So does that mean nothing's true? So it's really like a nothing burger for that argument. Any other comments or questions on that one? All right, here's another one. The problem of Christian hypocrites. So here's one quote that I found from Francis Maxwell. Christianity in America, or should I say the single greatest cause of atheism today. You know who I'm talking about, right? The type of people who acknowledge Jesus with their words and deny him through their lifestyle. And the article goes on to talk about different cultural ways that this guy at least sees that that's what's happening. There's a lot of people that are disenfranchised with God because of people that claim to worship God but misrepresent God. And this is one of the biggest reasons for people that I know in my life that say that Christianity is a joke. It's, they call them holy rollers. They're like cross necklaces and like talk about God, but are vindictive, stab you in the back kind of people. And people like that do a lot of damage to Christianity. But let's ask the same question we've asked with the other ones. What faith assumptions are behind this doubt? Yeah, that like Christians ought to be perfect. Like the Christian worldview teaches that none of us are perfect. So in a sense, shouldn't you kind of find that there are Christians that are not totally living up to the ideals of Christianity? Like that's kind of within our worldview, you know, that we won't live up to it perfectly. So that's one thing, yeah.
And that those who are following Christianity, I don't want to say accept, but like are excusing Christians who... so-called Christians who are doing wrong. So it's like, oh, well, we, you know, they claim Christianity or whatever, so we accept them, but they're doing all these wrong things. True Christians don't accept evil.
Right.
At any point. So.
Right. And so, like, in other words, like, for the Christian, do we have to defend the Crusades? No. No, there's a book that I just bought, by the way, that's written by some Calvinist guy that's trying to defend the Crusades. And I got it just to see, like, what in the world would they have to say about this? That's not anything we have to defend. Or John Calvin. Do you guys know that he put somebody to death? He had somebody executed. And there's another book that just came out where it's defending what he did there. And the person he put to death was a heretic. He didn't believe in Calvinism or something like that. And so if you bring that up to a Calvinist and you say, hey, like, did you know that John Calvin did have somebody put to death, and you'll know them by their fruits and all this kind of thing. The people are coming up with like sophisticated ways to defend what he did there. Do we have to do that? No. Do we have to defend Peter when he was seemingly having racial problems in Galatians chapter 2 by withdrawing from... No, we don't have to defend him. If it's a sin, it's a sin. So look at this quote from Timothy Keller. The typical criticism by secular people about the oppressiveness and injustices of the Christian church actually come from Christianity's own resources for critique itself. The shortcomings of the church can be understood historically as the imperfect adoption and practice of the principles of the Christian gospel. So he's saying here that when people say, you guys are hypocrites, to like say that with such vigor and strength, it, in an ironic way, is a way of affirming the Christian ideal. Do you see that? Like, you can't even think that. Like, if Christianity said to, like, kill everybody, do you think the atheist would go to a Christian that's not killing everybody and go, you hypocrite, you're supposed to kill everybody? No, they would kind of be happy that they're not living out those worldviews. But people can be frustrated that Christians aren't always living these things out because something within them actually affirms and appreciates what the Bible teaches. Otherwise, that wouldn't have any rhetorical power. Do you see the point? Any comments or questions on that? So I like Martin Luther King Jr. So he, in his I Have a Dream speech, do you think that African Americans were mistreated by people who said that they were Christians in the United States?
Yes.
A ton. And some of those people who owned slaves tried to justify it by the Bible. And does anybody happen to know, by the way, where they justified this from the Bible?
Isn't there some sort of convoluted, like, Shem and Ham?
Yeah, it goes from Genesis 9, where the descendants of Ham are going to be cursed. And the descendants of Ham went to Africa. So this was the prevailing thought in, like, the 1930s and before for segregation and for slave ownership, is that the Bible says these people are cursed, and so they don't count as people. And so people were holding up Bibles using this as their argument. They would have held up even Bibles at times to Martin Luther King and said these same things. Can you imagine being somebody like Martin Luther King and hearing people wave Bible verses at them in the wrong kind of ways? For the person today, they might go, that's why Christianity is a joke, is because you're misusing passages, trying to take advantage of other people, blah, blah, blah. But this is the Genesis 9 passage is what people who said that they believed in the Bible, that was the basis of their argument. Okay, so in the I Have a Dream speech, look what Martin Luther King Jr. said. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and the Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. What's he quoting from there? The Bible. From Amos chapter 6. Look at how Martin Luther King responded to this. People misusing Bible passages to support all these things. And then he says, how about this, guys? How about you start to live more consistent with the Bible rather than saying, I'm done with the Bible? That's a powerful example of how to properly handle religious hypocrites, is to say, how about you live more consistent with it? Because I do agree with the principles that are taught in there, rather than to walk away from it. Any comments or questions on that one? All right, Paul Copan, I'm just going to tack this one on. He says, the new atheists aren't willing to own up to the atrocities committed in the name of atheism by Stalin, Pol Pot, or Mao Zedong, yet they expect Christians to own up to all the barbarous acts performed in Jesus' name. That's just a good one. It just shows hypocrisy. So there you go, there's hypocrisy. Okay, in the other worldview. Anything else you guys want to say about this one?
I think in regards to this one versus the other three you can sort of confront with arguments, evidence, but this is one defined by actions.
That's a good characterization.
And, you know, if someone is complaining about hypocrisy, maybe you need to ask them, do you find anything hypocritical with me? And if they do have some grievances, and if you take a look at yourself, perhaps that is just that, perhaps that is technically, in a way, God telling you, hey, you know, shape up. You're kind of slacking here.
Right. I mean,
or if we see other people who claim to be Christians who are acting in a not Christian way and then trying to kind of, there was a guy I knew. I mean, you see, it's as you said, the type. They wear the crosses. They can quote a Bible verse every now and then, but their actions do not, and attitudes do not, match up to their words.
Right.
And, you know, it's very easy to roll your eyes and just not listen to them, but they are having an effect on others.
Yeah.
They may not have an effect on you, but they are having an effect on others.
Yeah, and by the way, if an atheist or a non-Christian ever says, like, hey, there's something in you that doesn't seem to fit in line, like, have a real dialogue, and if they point something out that's right, like, please admit to it and, like, let them even point things out to you. If they're seeing a legitimate thing that needs to be pointed out, because that kind of is a paradigm breaker for them. Matt?
This is also a point where you also need to know your Bible. Because just like you talked about how Christians in the 19, or people in the 1930s were using Genesis 9, I mean, for you to be able to stand and say, because there's going to be false accusations and twisting of scriptures, for you to be able to stand and say, no, this is wrong, you also have to know your scripture yourself.
Right.
So, I know the common one a lot today is, well, you can't be a Christian and have a tattoo or stuff like that.
Right. Really
use a scripture
from the Old Testament.
From the Old Testament and all of that. And so this one almost calls for you to, like, it's, you're told in, I think it's 2 Peter, to give a ready defense
right.
of the things you believe in. So you have to be able to be
right.
well-versed in that.
By the way, as long as we're talking some about the African-American stuff, you know, one of the most powerful arguments for how great Jesus is to show, and I don't know what beliefs they had about certain things, but where did the African-American slaves in the United States, where did they learn about Jesus? From their slave owners. And did they believe in Jesus? Like, they were some of the most spiritual people, singing hymns out in the fields and stuff like that. The fact that people who were being mistreated by these slave owners still believed in Jesus is a testimony to the greatness of what is revealed in the Bible, that they could hear it from such hypocritical people and still find something convincing about it. That's an undervalued, under-discussed aspect to the whole slavery movement.
See past.
They could see, they saw past a lot of these things. And but people today, they can't look past some of the hypocrisy of Christians because they're not seeing the jewel that Jesus is. In the Gospels, there's always the crowd that's hanging around Jesus, And people have got to get past the crowd to get to Jesus. The crowd today could be the hypocritical people that claim to believe in Jesus. Real faith moves past that. But the fact that African Americans could believe, have you guys ever even thought about that idea? It's so powerful. That Africans, yeah, there's a couple of hands. Nick and then you and then you.
I think it's always been interesting to me, at least, how the current critics of hypocrisy in the church and hypocrisy in general in Christianity are always willing to vomit rhetoric at you, just vomit rhetoric, and it's never about listening to what, you know, things like this. It's never about listening about, you know, what is the reason behind your faith? What is the reason why you believe what you believe? And yes, we're all imperfect human beings, and that's something, you know, you talked about, it's part of our ideals, but it's always about, you know, getting out what they have to say about your hypocrisy, and then it's shut down as soon as you get a response.
It's a very one-way street.
It is.
Yeah. Ian?
Well, two things. One, we have to make sure that we are not part of that, of the crowd that blocks people from Jesus, but perhaps maybe someone who can open a path in the crowd to Jesus.
Right.
And then the second thing, you know, we all make mistakes, but we also have to understand for the person who's who might be making this argument, you know, as we said before, people had a bad experience with Christianity. How bad was that experience? Because it could have just been something like, you know, they just had a bad run-in with someone who claimed to be
right.
Christian. Or it was a legitimate dark thing that occurred in their past kind of thing.
Right. I mean, like, there's people like that I know that have been really hurt by religious hypocrites. And so it's a real struggle. But Ben?
I was thinking about, like, you know, at the cross around Jesus, you know, are all of these people that had welcomed him into the city, you know, just like a week before. And how that can be us, you know, day to day. And the weakness of Christians in certain moments, doesn't discount the glory of God.
Right. That's why you gotta see past it. And slaves were able to. Like, are you in a worse situation than a slave? You know? So, all right. This last one, the problem of the conquest. This is another, again, we're just dealing with common arguments, not maybe the most philosophically robust, but the most common arguments in our society as to why people don't believe in God. But Richard Dawkins, I used this in a sermon recently, but in his book, The God Delusion, he famously says this: the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, and vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, whatever, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Alright, so one of the things that he's referring to here would have been the conquest, when the Israelites were told to go into the Promised Land and kill different people and stuff like that. So a couple of things to say about this, and this goes back to critiquing Christianity from within its worldview. I'm going to show you what I think, if I was going to make a top 10 list of most shocking passages in the Old Testament, because I can't just say what the number one would be, I don't know how to do that. But if I was to personally make a top 10 list of most shocking passages in the Bible, in the Old Testament, this would be somewhere in the top 10 list. 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 12 and 13. Arise, therefore, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die. And all Israel shall mourn for him and bury him. For only of Jeroboam shall come to the grave. Because in him there is found something pleasing to the Lord, the God of Israel, in the house of Jeroboam. All right, the context of this is Jeroboam in 1 Kings 12 has created the golden calves. 1 Kings 13, he's got this first worship service at this altar. The unnamed prophet comes, and he says, he prophesies against the altar, and the king says, seize this guy, and his hand gets withered up. And then the prophet says something else, or God, he prays for him, or whatever, the hand gets restored. The prophet dies from a lion on the way back because he didn't obey God. The next chapter is Jeroboam's wife going to inquire of what is going to happen to our family. And she goes, and this prophet that she talks to says that what's going to happen to your family, what's going to happen to your son who's sick, which is the more immediate question that that family has, is that, your whole family's going to die, but what's going to happen to this son that's currently sick?
He's
going to
die.
He's going to die. Well, what's the reason?
Because goes in him has found something pleasing to the Lord.
There's something pleasing. Have you ever noticed this? Like, what would this look like today? Like, let's say that there's a child that's got some kind of thing, a four-year-old kid that's on a deathbed, and mom and dad are wondering, how could a loving God let this happen? And the child dies. In this text, it's precisely because God is loving that the child dies. Do you see that? Because the rest of the family is going to be alive to be just totally like the way that the rest of the family is going to die, if you read the rest of the text, is going to be like they're going to be humiliated and everything like this. But this child is going to die now before this other more terrible disaster comes upon this family because God's pleased with that kid. So how does that apply to the conquest? Because people are always offended that it says kill women and children and little ones and all this kind of stuff. What does the biblical worldview say about children?
That they're going to heaven.
Yeah. That they're safe. That they're preserved. And so, if you want to criticize the Bible because of the conquest, do it from within the Bible's worldview. That's not the worst thing that could happen to those people. And so that at least answers the question about the kids that were killed in the conquest. We'll talk about the rest of the population next. But do you guys have any comments or questions about that? That this has become an extremely important verse when I've talked with skeptics. This is one to like circle or square or remember or something in your Bible.
I think you have to be careful with this argument, though, because what's to stop me from saying, so if I...
Abortion.
Well, not just that, but if I had a couple kids... I mean, you don't want to think about it, but let's just say you've got someone, they've got a couple of kids, and they're worried about those kids going out into the world. So what am I going to do? I'm just going to think, in my worldview, I think I'm going to send them a one-way passage to heaven by just smothering them that night. And, you know, if I have to sacrifice
I've heard some Christians justify abortion for the same reason.
No, but I'm not trying
to. No, I know.
I'm just saying, I think you have to be careful with this argument.
I agree.
Because, you know, and
based on that,
someone can interpret that wrong,
right,
and then commit very atrocious acts.
Yes,
after that.
And that's been brought up in these discussions that I've had. And the end for me, like, this child's dying from a sickness. The Bible never says to take life.
I know. I'm just saying.
I'm saying that's how I would answer
them. One person. Oh, it just takes, you know, someone getting it into their own head,
right?
You know. I can save this person's soul by killing them.
Right. Yep. All right, any other thoughts on that one? All right, here's another thing about the conquest. So Greg Kokel said this about it. Even by ancient standards, the Canaanites were a hideously nasty bunch. Their culture was grossly immoral, decadent to its roots. Its debauchery was dictated primarily by its fertility religion that tied eroticism of all varieties to the successful agrarian cycles of planting and harvest, in addition to divination, witchcraft, and female and male temple sex. Canaanite idolatry encompassed a host of morally disgusting practices that mimicked the sexually perverse conduct of their Canaanite fertility gods, adultery, homosexuality, transvestitism, pederasty, men sexually abusing boys, sex with all sorts of beasts, and incest. Note that the Canaanite city of Sodom was destroyed. Lot's daughters immediately seduced their drunken father, imitating one of the sexual practices of the city just annihilated. Worst of all, Canaanites practiced child sacrifice. Archaeological evidence indicates that the children thus burned to death sometimes numbered in the thousands. So when people say, well, how could God just have one nation go into another place and do all these things? Well, if news networks existed back then and they're saying, this is what happened in the land of Canaan today. Do you know what we'd be saying in the Western world?
Good.
And we'd be wondering, if so many years have passed, where's the God of justice? How could God allow this evil and suffering in the world? That's what we'd say. And then as soon as God does something about it, then we've got a problem with that. Like, how much, whenever there's been like terror attacks and there's like a leader of these people that are like against infidels and stuff, like, do we kind of rejoice a little bit when some of those people get taken care of so that they can't keep spreading the murder that they're doing? Yeah. And so if you look at the kinds of practices they had, what God was doing was using the Israelite nation as a vehicle of justice for something that we would all be appalled by. Ben?
And also, like, God's people in the Bible are asking God, when are these people going to be taken care of? You know, like, they're committing such atrocities, and he keeps saying, like, oh, their time is not complete. What, like, whether that's so that, you know, it can happen in his time, or so that they can find him at some point.